morning, everyone listening in. I'm Lawrence Fernstall, Vice Chair of the PERS Board. Chair Chinoy could not attend the full meeting today, and she asked me to chair in her place. As you know, we're meeting by phone, adapting like people throughout Oregon and throughout the world to the COVID-19 pandemic and following the governor's executive order to stay home and save lives. So I hope everyone is well, and we will proceed accordingly. If I could ask, particularly my fellow board members, when you speak, if you could identify yourself briefly at the beginning, I think that will help us take the minutes. Included in the materials for the meeting were the minutes of our last board meeting on January 31st. Are there any comments or corrections on those minutes?
This is Steve Buckley. I have two suggested amendments to the minutes that you and Mr. Demarest can help me with and confirm.
Okay.
The first suggested change is in the first paragraph on page one, which indicated that Mr. Fernstall attended by phone just prior to item C2. My recollection and notes were that Mr. Fernstall did not participate by phone, but in fact arrived and attended the meeting in person during the presentation of item C3.
Yeah, thank you for that. Actually, I did call, I had a board meeting at OHSU, and I did call in by phone at the time that is noted there.
Okay, so
I did listen to item C2.
Okay, so I think that the minutes are fine then. My
yes.
Second suggested change is on page 3 under item C3. The fifth paragraph states that I commented on PERS staff having reached its resource capability limits. And I think the statement in that paragraph, although I agree with it, was made by Board Member Demarest.
And this is Board Member Demarest, and I agree.
Okay.
So my only suggested amendment to the minutes would be section C3, fifth paragraph, substituting Board Member Demarest for Board Member Buckley. With that suggested amendment, I would move that the minutes of January 31, 2020 board meeting be approved as amended.
And Board Member Demarest seconds.
Very good. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you, and thank you both, Steves, for that correction. I appreciate it. Now let me turn to Director Olenek for the director's report.
Thank you, Vice Chair Fernstall, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, director, and welcome to the March 30th board meeting via teleconferencing. As Vice Chair Fernstall has noted, this has come about obviously as a result of the agency's efforts to work through the challenges we're facing in dealing with COVID-19 and continuing as best possible to maintain our operations, and more on that subject later. As always, we have a very interesting agenda to work through this morning. With respect to A2, the director's report, a few items to note within it. The first is, as noted, we had undertaken a tabletop pandemic exercise prior to year end. Fortuitous, I believe, is the best way to describe it. And we're very pleased that we had done that, as well as a significant amount of effort on all of our continuity of management plans in 2019, as they're serving us well as we understand how to operate in this COVID-19 era. A big thanks not only to our continuity management team in these preparations, but also to our incident response team. We're meeting on a daily basis to make sure that we can react as quickly as possible to changing events. As well, obviously, a shout out to all our staff who are showing great resiliency in adapting to new ways of working, At this time, we have slightly over 200 staff who are working from home with the remainder on site using appropriate social distancing within our buildings. We continue to do not only our daily operational work, but also Senate Bill 1049 implementation work, and I'm extremely proud of all our staff's efforts as they've stepped up through this. Second item to note is that last week we received the follow-up report on the Secretary of State IT and Continuity Management audit that was originally completed in late 2018. Given everything the agency has been dealing with, especially the implementation of Senate Bill 1049, I'm very pleased that the Secretary of State recognized we had taken significant steps in addressing the original findings. Of the 16 recommendations, 8 are complete, 5 partially complete, and 3 not started, and we'll have more discussion on that during the Audit Committee meeting following the board meeting today. That'd be item B8. Forward-looking calendar. Please note we've added 2 times for 2 special meetings so that we can deal with administrative rulemaking arising from Senate Bill 1049 implementation on a timely basis. 2 dates that we've noted in the forward calendar are Friday, April 24th at 1 p.m. and Tuesday, June 23rd at 9 a.m. These will be held via teleconference and should be relatively short in duration. And I'd like to thank the board members for responding to our request for dates so that we could nail these down as quickly as possible. Item 2C, budget execution, really nothing there out of the ordinary to note. Item A3, John Shervam will present the 2019 and cumulative investment performance overview shortly, and I expect we'll have a bit more discussion as to what's been happening in the markets now. And excuse me, did somebody just join the meeting? Was that John?
It is I.
Okay. I'm just going to do my director's report, and then soon thereafter will be yours.
Terrific.
So, nice timing, John, good because, as you're all aware, this is John's second last day as Chief Investment Officer here in Oregon. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank John for his exceptional efforts in transforming the investment division at Treasury during his tenure and working diligently to position the OPERF portfolio to be much more resilient during market conditions such as we're encountering today. Based on reports he sent out to OIC members, we're faring better than many other funds because of these efforts, and best of luck in your new role, John.
Thank you.
Items B, administrative rulemaking. Stephanie will be going through numerous rulemaking items. She'll speak to one update on 1049 member contribution redirect rules and 2 notice of rules. Item C1, Karen Chavez will present for the board's consideration and input the PHIP reserve policy. C2, Amanda Marble and Richard will be presenting for adoption the 2019 final earnings, crediting, and reserving recommendations. Yvette will then report out on progress in implementing Senate Bill 1049. C4, Marjorie will provide a 2020 leg session review, somewhat truncated, obviously. C5, Marjorie and Stephanie will provide an overview of the ledge concepts the agency is considering submitting for the 21 session. C6, Richard Horsford and Greg Gabriel will provide an update to the board on the 2021-23 budget development. And then C7, Milliman will be presenting for information and review of the current rate collaring approach. And obviously, this discussion becomes much more relevant and less academic given what the markets are undergoing at this time. Also like to take this time to recognize the efforts of Marjorie Taylor in her role as Senior Policy Advisor during her tenure at PERS. Obviously, for many years, played an integral part in putting forward the PERS perspective on the legislative front, not to mention in this last couple of years trying her best to educate a new director and sometimes trying to work through a very thick skull in that one. So all the best, Marjorie, and thank you for your efforts. That concludes my report, unless there are any questions.
Do any of the board members have questions for Director Olenek on his report?
This is Board Member Demarest. I don't have questions, but I would like to publicly congratulate the Financial Services Division staff for their honor roll certificate from Department of Administrative Services
and also to the agency for being a finalist in the Plan Sponsor of the Year Award. And finally, I will just like a tip of the hat to the flexibility and dedication of PERS agency staff as they're working through the pandemic we're in. Thank you all.
Thank you, Board Member Demarest. I would echo all of your comments and also add, I think it puts the agency in good light that we had done a pandemic disaster tabletop exercise. I think that shows the forward-looking nature of PERS. So it's terrific. Now we will move on to agenda item A3. Let me join the director by thanking John Sherman for his over 7 years of service as chief investment officer, tremendous service to Oregon and to PERS members. So welcome, John, and we wish you the best of luck, and we'll turn the presentation over to you now.
Thank you. Thank you for those kind words and that terrific introduction. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. I had my headset on, but for some reason it wasn't working, so I'm just using the handset on my regular telephone, and I've got the slide deck in front of me. Are people able to follow along?
Yeah, if you just want to call out which pages you're on, John, that would be appreciated.
Sure. And then one last question before I dive in. How much time do I have?
Go for it. It's your second last day.
Well, technically, this is my last official act, so I'm taking the afternoon and tomorrow as vacation days because the moving van is en route to my home. So this is the drop the mic moment for me.
Very good.
And couldn't think of a better group to do it with.
Very good. Take your time, John.
Okay, so I'm on slide two, and this is an update of the program. The assets under management, which at the end of calendar 2019 were almost $112 billion. That, of course, is a fond but now distant memory. The most important part is just to put it out there and illuminate the fact that OPERF is the engine that drives this train and gives the rest of the program huge economies of scale. Slide three is the source of much melancholy because at the end of the year, you see we had an all-time high, and that, of course, has passed. Slide four is now looking specifically at OPERF and looking at its asset allocation. And I think the most important comment I can share about OPERF is, as alluded to in Director Olenek's opening remarks, we really have transformed the composition of OPERF. So from a simplistic two-dimensional pie chart, you wouldn't be able to discern any changes. So I would suggest to you that this pie chart, just in terms of the size of the individual slices and the colors, I suspect it's not all that different than what my predecessor might have shown 10 years ago, what I might have shown on my first day on the job 7 years, 5 months ago. What's important is what's happened inside the individual pieces of the pie. That 10 years ago, 8 years ago, while the pie chart would have looked the same in terms of the size of the pie and the colors, inside each slice was a healthy dose of equity. There was what we call equity beta embedded just about everywhere in real estate, in fixed income, certainly within the public and private equity portfolios because that's what they're for, but there was equity risk everywhere. And so the most important understanding of the resilience that we have worked hard to build, and the way that resilience manifests, and I'm going to get wonky here for a second, that resilience should manifest and so far has manifested in a skew that the distribution of returns for OPERF, when there was equity risk embedded everywhere, were much more symmetric. To drop what is likely the first of several analogies, we used to hit for power. We were sluggers. We were the Barry Bonds of public pensions. We would often go up and hit a home run or strike out. But there was great symmetry of the returns. We've worked really hard to change that distribution. And huge caveat. We have an assumed rate north of 7. So you can never be asymmetric and truncate the left tail. That would be nirvana. I mean, nirvana would be go out and buy an annuity at 7.2, lay off the investment staff, and call it a day. That world doesn't exist. That's not an option that's available to us. So to be clear, we have not been able to truncate the left-hand side of the return distribution, and the first calendar quarter of 2020 is an excellent example of that. And the reason we can't truncate is because we have a 40-year horizon that we have to earn positive risk-adjusted returns, and it's an ambitious target right now, 7.2%. So we have to keep a lot of probability on that side. But we have built-in resilience in the form of a skew. Technically, it's a positive skew. And back to the baseball analogy, we've given up power in exchange for average. So we're not swinging for the fences as much as we used to. And as a result, we're hopefully not striking out as much. And instead, we're really focusing not on slugging percentage, but on on-base percentage. And the way that we've done that, back to the pie chart, is to work really hard and diligently and systematically de-risk certain parts of the portfolio, principally fixed income and real estate, by taking out that equity beta that snuck its way in over the years. It's impossible to purge it entirely. Again, we have to make 7.2%. But what we have done, again, on a very deliberate and systematic basis, is go through the portfolio and cull out the equity beta in certain asset classes, principally risk, fixed income and real estate, and refocus that equity beta where it's most rewarded, public equity, private equity. And that effort has generated a slight change in the distribution, not dramatic, but slight, and meaningful. Again, wonky, it's a positive skew. But it's an attempt to not ameliorate, but mitigate the left side of the distribution in exchange for more probability on the right-hand side of the distribution, although that probability is now, today, much more in singles and doubles and a lot less in home runs. So just to repeat, the pie chart doesn't look much different today than it did 10 years ago or even 8 years ago. But inside each of those pieces of the pie, pretty substantial change has been affected. This, everybody hopefully knows, the trade-off between risk and return. And back to the previous slide, we were taking a lot of risk in real estate and fixed income. And the problem with taking risk there is you don't get rewarded commensurately. So why am I going to spend a part of my risk budget, or why would I spend? This is kind of the high level, you know, first principles. Why would I spend precious amounts of my risk budget in fixed income when the payoff is a few hundred basis points? I can take that same risk and spend it in public or private equity and get multiples of that. So that's what we've done. We've made the fixed income and real estate portfolios much more conservative, much more defensive, and reallocated that risk in a very deliberate way where we think over the long horizon it will be rewarded. And that's principally in public and private equity. This is a slide from one of our general consultants, Callan. If you forget everything I talk about. This is the slide you should, you know, keep with you forever because it explains the entire challenge, the conundrum that we find ourselves in. It's not a challenge that's unique to Oregon, but this says it all. The amount of risk it takes today to generate the same returns. And so go back to 30 years ago, and you could have three quarters of the portfolio in cash and still make the return. So look at that six-time increase in risk over 30 years to get the same return. So that is the great challenge of our generation as fiduciaries. It's the great challenge of my generation as investment professionals. And again, I think this is probably the most powerful slide you should carry around with you to understand how difficult this job has become.
John, this is Steve Buckley.
Yeah.
And I think you're talking about the three pie charts on page six.
That is correct.
Is the expected rate of return for 2019 at 7.5% at all driven by the board's assumed rate of return for investments, or is it the Oregon Investment Council's determination of what constitutes a prudent amount of risk in the current investment environment?
Board Member Buckley, thank you for that question. It's an excellent question, and the answer is neither. So this slide is independent of the OIC. It's independent of you and your PERS board member. These are just Callan's broad-level capital market assumptions. So last calendar year, they look into the future and divine interest rates and economic growth and risk premia. And so these reflect, for the prior periods, they reflect realized returns, but for 2019, they reflect Callan's projections. So in that sense, they're generic. Nothing specific, nothing customized to Oregon. That's why I say this is the challenge, this is the conundrum that faces us all. There's no, you know, there's no, I don't have another gear to go to in my gearbox. I don't have, you know, a special asset class that is undiscovered. This is the challenge we all face.
Maybe another question then. Does the PERS board's long-term investment assumption influence the Oregon Investment Council's asset allocation or investment return goals?
Another excellent question. I'm not sure I'm, you know, the ultimate arbiter of that decision. My belief and my experience is that it's really the other way around, that the council has a charge embedded in their fiduciary mission to try and find the balance between achieving a positive and strongly positive long-term return after inflation adjusted for risk, while at the same time being highly sensitive to short-term volatility. And there's no formula for that. That is really, I talk a lot about with staff and with our constituencies about the investment management, institutional investment management being part art, part science. And my story is we historically as an industry have relied too much on art and need to rely more on science. But this is the one where this is really art. There's no magic formula in a textbook to tell you what's the right balance between portfolio construction that moderates short-term volatility but also captures enough of the upside long term to maintain solvency. So that's really what the council's paramount responsibility and paramount charge is, more than anything. So I think you have identified the single most important thing that the Oregon Investment Council does, and that is to try and find that balance. And frankly, it's right in the, I don't know if it's the preface, but it's right in the first part of the OIC's governance policy documents. And when you read it, it's very subjective, right? There's no magic formula. And it's ongoing, and that's why we do a deep dive on asset allocation every April. And that's why we constantly update that process with our consultants' expectations of long-term returns. But it very much is art to try and figure out what is the most aggressive portfolio we can build to capture long-term equity premia that generate strongly positive returns in the long term that maintain fund solvency, but not go too far that we blow it up in the short term and push it all on, you know, contributions to make up the gap.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.
And if you come across that magic formula, let me know, because, you know, we could take over the world. So this is 2019 performance, and I want to spend some time on the next two charts. This is 7 and 8, because this is the empirical support for what I talked about earlier, changing the distribution of OPERF returns, changing it from what was historically pretty symmetric to something that's slightly less symmetric, slightly asymmetric, slightly skewed on the positive side. And another big caveat is, it took us a long time to get here. We've got what I would argue are three data points in support of a preliminary, very preliminary proof statement that says it's working. Hey, John, you and the team did all this work. Is it working? My answer, I've got three data points that suggest it is, but gigantic asterisk, very premature. In a strict, and what I mean by that is my alma mater, University of Chicago, statistical, robust statistical proof statement would need 30 years of data and a t-stat of greater than 2 to say with great confidence it's working. So, you know, I don't have 30 years. I have three data points over the last, say, 2 years, but it's a really good start. So that's the preface to these two slides. Let me talk about 19, and then we'll go to my data point. So 19, you can see they're right in the middle of the page. OPERF, net of all fees, earned 13.6. Now, if I came up to any one of you in isolation and said, would you take 13.6? You'd say all day long, that's almost double the assumed rate. Now, if I came to you individually and said, asked you a different question, said, would you take bottom of the barrel relative returns? Hey, I've got a proposition for you. It's January 1. 2019, would you like to be in the 99th percentile at the end of this year? You say, well, let me make sure I understand. 99th percentile is bad, right? And I go, yeah, it's like at the bottom. So isn't that interesting? If we ran that experiment on January 1, 2019, I came to you individually in isolation and said, would you like 13.6? I think there'd be unanimity in saying yes. If I said, would you like 99th percentile in isolation, individually, I think there'd be unanimity in you saying no. And yet both of those things are true. The fund earned almost double the assumed rate last year, but that was close to dead last. Maybe it was dead last in our large public plan peer group. So that's my third data point. Very, very good absolute returns, very poor relative returns. Why? Because it was a barn burner of a year in 2019. Look at those equity numbers at the top, the S&P, the Russell 2000, 30% returns in public equity markets. OPERF has a much lower allocation to public equity than its peer group. As you saw in the beginning of the slide, we're down below 35% in public equities. Most of our public plan peers are north of 40, some north of 45. So, we're building these data points. We're building a proof statement. I can tell you with absolute certainty, anytime the market rallies, equities rally 20, 25, 30%, our relative our absolute performance will be very satisfactory, and our relative performance will be very poor. Having nothing to do with costs, having nothing to do with the strategies we pick, having nothing to do with the managers we pick, having nothing to do with the execution of our internal strategies, just by virtue of the fact that we own a lot less publicly traded stocks than our peers. At the margin, we own more private equity. At the margin, we own more what we call alternatives, which is an eclectic group of investment strategies that don't include real estate, that don't include private equity, agriculture, minerals, mining, timber, things, infrastructure, things like that. So in the spectrum of portfolio construction, OPERF looks much more like an endowment, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, et cetera, than it does its public plan peer group. We think that's a good thing. We think that gives us the skew, modest as it might be, and gives it resilience. But in a year like 2019, I can, this part I can guarantee. I don't need 30 years of data before I can give you a robust statistical proof statement. Any year the market rallies like it did in 19, we will underperform on a relative basis. But again, back to the experiment. On January 1, 2019, if I took each of you in a conference room and said, you want 13.6, you say all day long. So now I'm on slide 8.
John, this is Steve Buckley. Could I interrupt you again?
Sure.
On a down equity market, would you expect to outperform?
Boy, you are good. You are good. Let's go to slide 8. So I just, the 2019 performance was data point number 3. Let's go to data point number 2. And that's 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And 2018 answers your question. It answers it empirically. Our peer group, so you can see at the top of the slide in 18, the S&P 500 was down 4.4%. Our peer group median, so the same peer group that we ran against in 2019, that peer group in 2018 was negative. In 2018 was negative, round numbers, 2.5. And as you can see right in the middle of the page, in 2018, OPERF earned a positive return of essentially half a percent. So run the experiment. January 1, 2018, run the experiment. I take each of you individually into a conference room and said, would you like to be in the top 10% of your peer group in calendar year 2018? I think each one of you would say all day long. We run the other side of the experiment. I take you into a conference room individually and I said, would you like to earn just barely above zero in 2018? I think there'd be unanimity in saying, no, we need more than that. So it's happily convenient for me that as I ride off into the sunset, we have a dramatic example of of the changes that staff has implemented and this modest skew that we've built into the portfolio. That we are giving up the home runs so that we don't strike out as much. We are giving up the slugging percentage, and we are trying to maximize on-base percentage. My third data point is unofficial. My third data point is calendar year 2020. It's unofficial, it's preliminary. I don't have any peer group comparisons. The peer group comparisons won't be available until late April, maybe early May. Our audited performance numbers won't be available until middle of April. So, but my crack operations team came in early this morning to crunch some numbers and give us a preliminary estimate of first quarter 2020 investment performance for OPERF. Again, huge caveat, this is preliminary, unaudited, blah, blah, blah. But our estimate for the first quarter will be down a negative 7.8 in the first calendar quarter. We will be down negative 7.8. Purely speculation, because we won't see the peer group results until May. I'm quite certain that'll be top quartile relative to our peer group, and I would not be surprised in the least if it's top decile. So the first calendar quarter of 2020 is a more severe version of 2018, where the resilience that we've built into the portfolio has not inoculated OPER from losing money. That is impossible. I can't earn a positive long-term return and inoculate the portfolio from losses. Those are mutually exclusive outcomes. So we can't inoculate OPER from losing money, but as I suggested, we are losing a lot less money than our peer group because we own a lot less public stock. We have a much more diversified portfolio. We have particular strategies in the alternatives bucket, trend following in particular, that take advantage of bear markets. So we're down 8%, and I suspect that's good for top quartile or top, maybe even top decile.
John, yeah. This is Lawrence. I calculated right this morning. Roughly speaking, the S&P 500 is down about 20% first quarter. So that would be fantastic relative performance and would speak well to two points, I think. One is the positive skew you built in and you described to us very clearly this morning. And second, that OPERF is a lot more than just the U.S. stock market. So when people see every day the Dow Jones or the S&P 500, they should realize that you put in place and the Oregon Investment Council has put in place a much more sophisticated strategy.
Member, first of all, thank you for those Vice Chair. First of all, thank you for those remarks, both spot on. Sorry, but it's preliminary, so I have to keep throwing out the caveats. The caveat to our estimates is that OPERF is much closer to an endowment with lots of private assets. Those private assets are appraised on a quarterly basis, so those appraisals are stale.
Yes, sir.
And so my numbers really are a function of stale appraisals on private assets, but like your own, pretty good estimates of the publicly traded securities, which comprise 60% of the portfolio, mainly stocks and bonds, and then the liquid strategies and alternatives like trend following.
John, if I could ask you to do the rest of the slides in about 5 minutes or so, I think you've really focused on the most important piece of what we need to hear.
Sure. I just want to make one other comment in response to Vice Chair Fernstahl's remark about we own everything. And yes, it's OPERF is not a, or a Dow Jones or an S&P is not a good proxy. Oregon's a cute little state with only 4 million people. I'm from LA. There's 4 million people west of the 405. But it has a very, large institutional investment operation. The fund is, you know, not only among the most reputable, but it's one of the biggest. It is the state's 800-pound, you know, financial gorilla. And because it's so large and complex, it owns everything all over the world. We own a piece of just about everything all over the world, private assets, public assets. And then because of what we've done over the last several years and diversified it, it's even more broadly diversified. So that's a good point to always keep in mind. I think the rest of this is talking about the – well, I know what it's talking about. It's talking about the contribution from the active management. In our world, it's the private market assets. So you've got some numbers on page 9. And then just constantly reminding everybody that we take advantage of our competitive position and try to exploit our competitive advantages. Our main competitive advantage is that we're in Tigard, Oregon, so we have a what I call a manufacturing. We can manufacture plain vanilla strategies cheaper than New York City or San Francisco. We don't try to do anything that requires skill because we can't recruit and retain the level of skill to execute those strategies, so that would be private equity and real estate. But things like plain vanilla stock and bond mandates, those things we can manufacture here in Tigard cheaper than, again, New York or San Francisco. So slide 10 is always our check on our costs. And the good news is among not so much our peer group, but when it comes to costs, we compare ourselves to the best performing funds, whether they're sovereign wealth funds or public pension funds. And so we're always happy to get a good report card on our costs. Slide 11 is cost savings. Again, this is taking advantage of the low-cost manufacturing environment we have in Tigard relative to New York City. And then even with plain vanilla mandates, index and systematic strategies on slide 12, we have put together a very compelling proof statement for adding some value at the margin. Just to get technical, we don't try to pick stocks. We don't do anything skill-based like that. But we do take advantage of trading and systematic strategies, index strategies. We trade around index reconstitution dates, things like that. These are kind of basic, just blocking and tackling technical execution strategies that, you know, slowly but surely are adding value and saving money. The operations group has been fantastic in identifying errors and omissions among our various vendors. And then the last thing I'll say, and see if there's any other questions, one of the proudest achievements for me has been the reconstitution of IAP. Can you imagine the phone calls you all would be getting, the phone calls I would be getting, if we did not do this? That if the cohort of PERS members that 60 to 65 either in retirement or getting ready to retirement, if they had 100% of their IAP in OPERF, they would be very unhappy campers. So it now comprises 10% of the fund. I would suggest to you that the changes that we made together in reconstituting IAP and having it much better reflect each member's individual risk tolerance, that should be on the highlight reel for a long time. And that's it. So happy to take any additional questions.
Right.
John,
thank you, John. Hey.
You've had to work very hard over your tenure to build up the human capital within the Oregon Investment Council and bring as much work as possible in-house. Are you where you want to be at this point, or do you need, or would you like, and would Mr. Would your successor like to have additional money to bring in more human capital, more employees in-house?
Thank you for the question. The answer is we are exactly where we need to be in terms of boots on the ground. And it's really, this is pretty wonky, but it's really important for people to understand that we can't insource everything and we don't want to insource everything. The great majority of our investment strategies require skill that demands compensation at levels we cannot pay. Private equity, alternatives, real estate. We don't ever want to insource those mandates because we could never attract the talent that it takes to compete at the top of the food chain in those asset classes. But publicly traded stocks, high grade, intermediate duration bonds, we've got a talented team. Those are not skill-based assets. Those are manufacturing mandates. We have Aladdin, world-class infrastructure. We can do that stuff all day long. But I would suggest that we're done. We've done what we needed to do. We have insourced those asset classes that are manufacturing-based, not skill-based. We have we have finely tuned the execution using our Aladdin system. We've got the middle office. Now we've got the back office compliance, financial accounting, legal. I would say we're where we need to be. This was part of former Deputy Treasurer Bond and negotiations that he made in the summer of, 2016, and negotiated for two bienniums worth of FTEs. And round numbers, we got 20 of them in 17-19, and we got another 10 in 19-21, and we are where we want to be. In fact, my senior team and I have been working on our concepts for 21-23, and our mantra has shifted. Our mantra used to be head count, we need more boots on the ground. Now our mantra is headroom. We have a top-performing program. We have one of the world's strongest, best investment brands. We were able to recruit, with that position authority that we got in 17-19 and 19-21, we were able to recruit a bunch of fantastic people, mainly young people, fantastic. So the challenge for my successor, the challenge for new Deputy Treasurer Michael Kaplan, and ultimately for Treasurer Reed, is we're where we need to be. We've got all the boots on the ground. We've got the systems. We are firing on all cylinders. Now we need to create headroom and career paths for people so that they remain just as excited about the mission as they were when they joined. That's the primary challenge going forward.
Thank you, John. Are there any more questions from the board? If not, John, thank you very much, and we'll let you get to your movers, and best of luck to you.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks, John.
Yep.
Okay, on the agenda, now we turn to administrative rulemaking, and let me turn the telephone over to Stephanie Vaughn.
Good morning. Vice Chair Fernstall, members of the board, for the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. We'll start with item B1, which is an update on our rulemaking for our member redirect rule. Member redirect is one of the provisions from Senate Bill 1049, in which a portion of the member's monthly contribution is redirected to a new account, the Employee Pension Stability Account. And of all the provisions of Senate Bill 1049, this is the heaviest lift for us on implementation. We've broken it down to a number of subgroups for that implementation. And in order to align the administrative rules with, or the adoption of the administrative rules with the implementation or the effective date of that provision, which is July 1st of 2020, we are pushing out, or we are scheduling the notice and adoption of the rules related to member choice give staff more time to properly implement those provisions. To that end, we scheduled a supplementary board meeting for April to notice the rules and another supplementary board meeting in June, the end of June, to adopt those rules. And we appreciate the board's assistance and openness to having those additional meetings for us. Are there any questions on that? Okay.
Okay. We'll go on to the IRS limitations.
Yes, item B2. This is noted for our rules on implementing the IRS limits. These are rules, we update these every year to bring us in line with the IRS limits. This is notice only, so there's no action required, and we will be bringing these forward for adoption at the May board meeting. Excuse me. Item B3 is notice of our rules implementing the member choice provisions of Senate Bill 1049. This is allowing members to choose a target date fund that is more in line with their risk tolerance, as opposed to the default target date fund that they are placed in based on their birth year. This provision is effective January 1, 2020. However, members would need to make their elections for a different target date fund by September 30th in order for PERS and Treasury to make all of the investment adjustments necessary to make that election effective January 1 of 2020. So we are noticing the rules now, and we will adopt them or bring them forward for adoption in May. This is notice only, so no action is required. Are there any questions?
Board Member Demarest.
Yes.
A comment and a question. So on attachment B3, attachment 1, first page, you have a new proposed section there, subsection D, regarding defining valid election. And on line 10 there, this is a suggestion for staff to consider there, after the word balance, to have their IAP count balance invested. I suggest that the staff consider inserting after the word balance and any new IAP contributions. And then my question has to do with the next page, where you the new paragraph 6, each calendar year from January through September, a person make one valid election. And then in sub B, in the event that a member submits more than one election in a calendar year, PERS will only consider the valid election with their earliest receipt date. So my question is, why the earliest receipt date and not the last receipt date? I mean, if someone submits a member submits an election choice and they change their mind and submit a different one, why would you stick them with the earliest one?
Board Member Demarest, yes, that is a good question, and it's something that we've discussed internally. The statute specifically only allows one election per year, and that election is effective January 1st of the next year. If somebody submits another election, that's allowing them to make more than one election. So if they make one election, that is locked in. And then if they wanted to change that, they'd have to wait until the next year in order to change that election.
Even though it had not become effective.
Right. So the statute specifically states, yes, they have one election, and that election is effective January 1 of the next year. And also, it's a processing issue from an administrative standpoint. If we took the last one, essentially we wouldn't be processing them through the year. We'd have to make those elections earlier because we'd be processing every single election on September 30th so that we would be sure to get everybody's last election that they made. So if we're processing them throughout the year, they've made their election, that election is locked in, and then they'd have to make their change or change. If they change their mind, they'd have to wait until the next year to make another election.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, I think we now go to C1. Let me ask Karen Chavez to walk us through this.
Good morning, Vice Chair Fernstahl and members of the board. For the record, I'm Karen Chavez, PERS Health Insurance Program Manager. I'm here to introduce the proposal for updating the PERS Health Insurance Program Reserve Model. Given the changes in contractual funding arrangements, we believe it's in the best interest of the PHIP members to reduce the amount of reserves being held over a period of approximately 7 to 11 years. As outlined in the memo, PHIP no longer requires the level of reserves as were previously required under the minimum premium arrangements due to changes with our health insurance contracts. In reviewing and remodeling the PHIP reserves, we outlined a restricted reserve that would be limited for the use in the event the program is terminated, and unrestricted reserves, which would be used to credit member rates. And we welcome any comments you may have on those proposed guidelines. The other consideration for the board is in regards to the drawdown timeline of the unrestricted reserves. We have presented three conceptual drawdown models outlining the PHIP member rate credits over the period of 7, 9, or 11 years. The report is based on the proposed guidelines included in the board memo, and the chosen drawdown model would be incorporated into the annual PHIP rate setting report to the board. In essence, what we're asking for is to know the preferred amortization period, and then we would incorporate that into the proposed rate setting at the May meeting.
This is Lawrence Fernstahl. I read this through several times, and let me see if I got it right, sort of from a bottom line perspective.
Sure.
Because of changes over time in the PERS health insurance programs, we no longer need to keep as large reserves as we have now. And the question you're really asking the guidance of the board for is, should we amortize or take these reserves in against rates over a 7-year period, a 9-year period, or an 11-year period, where if we take it in over a 7-year period, there will be a larger credit or reduction to rates, but for a shorter period of time, while if we take it over, say, an 11-year period, there will be a smaller reduction, but it will occur over a longer period of time.
That's correct.
That's what the question to the board is?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
This is Stephen Buckley. What is the approximate amount of excess reserves that could be available as a credit or a subsidy for current and future enrollees?
Currently, the total of the unrestricted reserves is approximately $94 million.
And you're suggesting that on a going-forward basis, the required reserve would be approximately $8 million?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, that is correct.
So there's approximately $86 million or so in excess reserves that can be used as a credit or a subsidy on a going forward basis.
to PERS health insurance members. That is correct.
So what were...
Let me ask the board members, and maybe we can take it one at a time, for what your sense is as to a shorter time period with higher credits, a medium time period with medium credits, or a longer time period with smaller credits. And on it's page 3 of 3 of this document, which is, I think, is slide 45 of 77 of the entire packet. You can see it's you can see that the percentage estimates there of what model credits would be.
This is Stephen Buckley. I'll take a swing at it first. My first comment would be that perhaps you would consider some type of a reserve cushion or a reserve contingency above the current required $8 million in case that reserve increases in the future. My initial recommendation would be to go with the 7-year credit for two reasons. Number one is to get the issues taken care of short term rather than long term, and secondly, the credits under the 9 and 11 year amortization schedule, when you get out to the last couple of years, are relatively small. Would have a relatively small impact on the enrollees' rates, and perhaps that impact might be ameliorated by the additional costs that are incurred internally in applying those credits over the last 2 years under a 9-year model, or the 4 years under an 11-year model. So my initial reaction would be a 7-year spend down.
Okay, thank you, Member Buckley.
This is Board Member Demers, and I'll jump in with my personal thoughts and recommendations. My recommendation is the 9-year model credits. In general, as you can see, the farther you go out, then the smaller the year-to-year impact. At least in the near term, the smaller year-to-year impact credits. And I think that's a goal. You don't want to see significant or big rate impact up front, which can then turn around in subsequent years and cause a larger swing in the rates. On the other hand, I'm not recommending 11 years. The reason for that is there's another factor to be considered, is that the people who benefit, ideally, the people who benefit from these rate credits are the people who were members or participants while the reserves were being built up. And again, they're the ones that should benefit. So the farther you go out, the more that group's going to drop off, and you have new participants coming in. So that's why I'm going for the middle road here, the 9 years. Thanks.
Yeah. Board Member Jaramillo here. I could get on board with 9 years or 11 years. In the near term, they're identical. What I expect is going to happen on this entire front of health insurance is that the plan experience and the actuarial experience that unwinds over the next 12 to 24 months is going to mean a lot of this modeling is going to get revisited in real time. With that in mind, I consider the more conservative of the path. So either 9 or 11 years would work for me. That's my input.
Thank you all. I mean, I had a similar, similar to all the comments, the idea about that Member Buckley noted about perhaps having a reserve, although I thought about, well, maybe if one went to the 9 or the 11, that would give us time to see whether a reserve, a bigger contingency, if you would be needed. I was concerned about the potential impact, particularly up front, about health care costs, although I guess some of that is mitigated by our not having having a different plan structure here. And then finally, the Board Member Demarest's point about trying to match the who paid in to who gets the benefit in terms of the time period seemed reasonable. I was comfortable with either 9 or 11 years myself. Being a finance guy, I tend to be conservative and take longer periods, but the middle one I would be comfortable too with. So we have a range. I guess I would ask Member Buckley if you would be comfortable with a 9-year recommendation, having heard the conversation.
Yes, I would. The other thing that we might consider is having Ms. Chavez and her staff come back with a recommendation to us at the next meeting.
Yeah.
They know the plan, the ins and outs of the minimum premium requirement and contractual reserves much better than the board members.
This is Director.
Let me ask Director Olenek, has the conversation we had given you enough guidance to come back to us, or are you looking for a resolution at this time?
No, this is Director Olenek. I think we're good with what we've got today. We didn't want to just spring it upon the board with the pricing that comes up at a future meeting. We want to get sort of the board's ideas of where they're leaning, and we can incorporate that into the pricing that we propose going forward.
Yeah.
So thank you for your...
Okay, so thank you for that conversation. I appreciate the opportunity for us to weigh in. The next meeting, if there are no further questions there, is item C2. Final earnings crediting and reserving. And I think we have Richard and Amanda, I hope, on the phone.
Good morning, Vice Chair Fernstall and members of the board. This is Richard Horsford, CFO at PERS.
Good morning, this is Amanda Marvel, Financial Reporting Manager from PERS.
As you look at item C2, this is the final earnings calculations that's the follow-up from the preliminary earnings that were presented at the last board meeting. Going through here, there have been some relatively minor changes to a number of the categories as we've finalized the both the estimates into actuals and fees. Most of those are a slight reduction in the overall earnings rates, but no significant changes. So given that, I will open this up and see if any board members have specific questions or would like to try to dig into any of the items in particular.
Are there any questions from the board on the final earnings crediting for 2019 or comments? If not, do I hear a motion to adopt the final crediting for earnings as presented?
This board is Member Ottomio, so moves.
Steve Buckley, second.
Any further questions or comments? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The resolution passes. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Now if I could ask our Deputy Director to give us a report on SB 1049 implementation.
Good morning, Vice Chair Fernstall, members of the board. For the record, Yvette Elledge-Rhodes, Deputy Director. So this is your regular Senate Bill 1049 implementation update. You will, I think we had inadvertently left out the two attachments, the Senate Bill 1049 Implementation Program Monthly Status Report, as well as the updated roadmap, and I think Katie has now sent those to you. So I'll refer to those as I go through this. So overall, the Senate Bill 1049 program at the program level, the Project Health remains yellow. That's mainly due to three of the projects have not been, their schedules have not been baselined. We are still seeking Stage Gate 3 endorsement as well. New to this report is that we are evaluating the COVID-19 impacts to the project. We have identified some new risks, those being with staff being unavailable due to illness, loss of productivity because of work, the majority of the team is telecommuting, and just the overall impact of available resources as well. And so for the individual projects, I did have a mistake on the Project Health for Employer Programs. I think right around the time we were developing this report, that project did go to yellow. So all the projects are yellow with the exception of the Work After Retirement project. For employer programs, I think the couple things I want to just call out is I think the COVID impacts have been most felt on this project because they were in the middle of conducting their employer focus groups. We were able to hold two of them. The third one had to be canceled. They are looking at holding phone surveys instead to get the needed feedback from employers. So I think we'll still be able to get the information that we desired through that. We also had a plan to visit CalPERS at the end of April. That has been postponed. And that was to meet with them, gather information requirements on the tool for the UAL resolution program. So that has been delayed as well. Additionally, we are hearing from some employers that are rescinding their applications or for lump sum payments. We've had a couple school districts rescind their applications, and another couple of special districts reduce their lump sum payments that we hadn't, they were scheduled, I think, further in the year, but they have now asked to reduce those. So we'll be looking at the wait list and how we'll be managing if we do have additional dollars available. For salary, the salary limit project, again, that one is also yellow. That one is mostly due to the schedule not being baselined, as well as we have a work package 4 that is actually much more complex than originally thought, and this is dealing with the proration of a partial year termination. So when a member terminates in the middle of the year, they we have to look at their salary to see if they would have reached the $195,000 limit and prorate on a per month basis. So programming for that is just a lot more complex than thought. It does touch quite a few of our programs, data verification, retirements, estimates, that sort of thing. As I said, Work After Retirement is green. We'll celebrate that one because that one is going fairly well. For Member Redirect, that project has always been yellow just because of the comprehensive scope of that project. They're working on baselining their short-term schedule this week, so that is good progress. We also reached Stage Gate 3 endorsement for the Member Redirect portion of that project. For voluntary contributions, you will, if you've had a chance to look at the roadmap under Member Redirect, you'll see that we did add some release dates for voluntary contributions, and we're focusing on a September 30th release date for the capturing member elections. You will see also that for voluntary contributions, The remaining work packages will be done at the end of November. This is a big risk for this portion of the project because I think the employer impact is a lot greater because we're going to have to try to get those contributions reconciled in a short time frame. So we're working out the details on that. We are engaging our employer advisory group, and whenever we can engage with employers, getting their feedback on the impacts of this and feedback on how to best work with their reporting cycles and gathering that data. For member choice, that project also yellow, mainly because we had a key resource leave the agency. They were actually a contractor. They left, had a lot of knowledge about our current system, and getting someone back up to speed does take a little time. But I'm happy to say that we're mitigating those issues right now. Any questions high level on any of the projects that I've just reviewed? So for other highlighted activities going on in the projects, we are working with Gartner for our quality management activities. We did complete the initial risk assessment recommendations, our responses to those recommendations, and have also developed action plans to make sure we are completing those. We're also preparing for an April quarterly assessment. So Gartner comes in and, well, they'll be doing it virtually this time, but interviews a good portion of the project staff to see if we have made improvements and where we're sitting with the projects. They've also completed the quality standards, quality management plan, and the quality management work plan deliverables that they were scheduled to deliver. We are seeing some key resource impacts only. We're fully staffed on the project, but we have had a product owner leave. We're backfilling that already very successfully, so that hasn't been an issue yet, but we will be doing a recruitment on that position in the near future. And then, as I had stated before, also really looking at the COVID-19 impacts and just making sure that if we did have to curtail staffing or telecommuting or anything like that, we would be very prepared to make decisions on what are the highest priorities of the project to get done so we can make sure we have resources on those. So it's really just some analyzing some scenarios and making sure that we are tracking those risks. The resources, as I stated, for the project were fully staffed. We do have some Deloitte resources coming on board in April, and they are actually going to be augmenting three of our positions. We're going to be bringing in a program director, an application delivery lead, and a quality assurance test coordinator. Those in the first month, those folks from Deloitte will actually be assessing how we're doing and looking to see where they can augment our staff, meaning if they notice any gaps, they'll be writing up recommendations of how they would be assisting us in the future months going forward. So we're looking forward to that. I will never turn down help if we can get it. So we're looking forward to those resources coming on board. It will be done virtually, so that will be interesting to see how they're able to assess, but I think we'll be able to get that done. Our Enterprise Information Services StageGate requirements, as I stated before, we did reach StageGate 3 on the member redirect for the short-term solution, and I'm still trying to get all the documentation in for StageGate 3 for the program. Member Choice is the only other project that will go through the full StageGate process. So they're getting all those documentation documents in ready for review as well. On the budget side, on the status monthly status report, I think gives a good overview on page 2 of the way we have broken out the budget by project, and you'll see that we are expecting to spend about $32 million with a remaining $4 million at this time. And I'm saying at this time because we haven't done all we needed to do for long-term scope for the member redirect project. For communications, a lot going on in that area. Internally, really, based on one of Gartner's recommendations, we're really trying to bring more to the table for organizational change management. And so that includes making sure our staff are informed. We're covering all the as-is processes and the to-be processes, mapping as well as training, and making sure all of those milestones are captured in the project deliverables. On the internal member or internal employee communication side, we have really ramped up a lot of our website, our intranet, that sort of thing, to make sure our staff feel they have the most up-to-date information. For external communications, we are continuing to update our website. I'm happy to announce that our new videos are actually live to the public. We put 2 new web pages out there. Unfortunately, internally, our staff can't review those because we've stopped our streaming of videos due to our bandwidth on our internet when we have so many folks telecommuting. But those videos are out there for our membership to watch. They have their 3 videos all explaining what is the IAP and how does Senate Bill 1049 impact your IAP. And it's really very short, well done, I think, as a way for our members to really understand the impacts to their IAP accounts. We are also targeting our April perspectives to have additional information, as well as our annual statements in May. We'll have some inserts on member choice, as well as member redirect. We did have also an opportunity to present at the OGFOA conference in early March. That was actually very eye-opening because the employers in attendance, some were not aware of Senate Bill 1049 impacts. So I think we really got out in front of this group, and we're being asked to provide additional information at another conference in the summer. We'll see how our attendance in those venues actually goes as we navigate what we call COVID-19. I also wanted to just call out some operations impact in a little more detail than in the board memo. So we know that we had backfilled a lot of our staff that we had moved to the project, and managers have been mitigating that with filling those resources. I believe we are over the hump in hiring. I think we've got about 10 or so left to hire in those operation positions. But on the positive side, having our staff move around and either stretch in roles or move into the limited duration positions has actually given us a lot of bench strength and further training in areas. So I think that will help over time. But the impact on some of our processes, I wanted to just let you know, I compared January and February of how we were doing. On the estimates side, where we've always kind of struggled because we have high volume there, we are not completing estimates in 30 days about 50% of the time. But I will say when I compared the volume of what we did complete, we actually have been completing more from January to February. So I think we might be over the hump in that area to be able to provide those as quickly as possible. We are seeing a delay in processing retirements. You know, we try to pay all members within 45 days, and we are seeing that service level dip as well. On the employer service center side, the impact of Senate Bill 1049 is a little different. In one of our solutions for the work after retirement, we decided to prevent records from posting. So our staff there are manually fixing employer reports so that they can post successfully. We did hire a temporary staff to help in that area, but it's just a large workload for them to work through. And then unrelated to Senate Bill 1049, we did see a huge spike in phone calls for many various reasons other than Senate Bill 1049. But I think with the hiring of new staff, with the Finolo call center feature that we rolled out last year, that has helped answer those calls. We did receive almost 6,000 more calls in February 2020 than we did in February 2019. So it's quite a huge jump. And then I think additionally the employer reporting impact is going to start playing out as you see these projects deploy some of their work packages. We know the work after retirement is a big impact on employers at this time just for posting retiree records. But they also aren't able to submit invoices and payments related to those retirees working after retirement. So that's a big impact. We know voluntary contributions will also be another employer reporting impact in the fall if any of our members are going to start electing that. And then I think just overall our inability to automate some of these as quickly as possible will just be an impact. We are evaluating how we would handle any manual or workarounds to lessen that impact as we can. That is pretty much my summary and overview of our what's going on right now. Are there any questions from the board?
This is Steve Demers with a question. Yvette, so you said that the agency's ability to meet its goal of 45 days for retirees has been impacted. So for people that are currently retiring, when can they expect their first pension check?
So Board Member Demarest, members of the board, I believe we are still meeting our goal to pay all retirees within 90 days. I think the delay, for example, I think we had been hitting 80-85% of retirees being paid within 45 days. It's probably now around 60% instead of the 80-85%. So the delay could just be a couple weeks. It could be a month. But we are still making sure we're getting payments out by our deadline. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Ben. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Yvette? Great. Thank you for that that report and the tremendous amount of work that's going on throughout PERS to continue the implementation. Now let me turn to C4, a review of the 2020 legislative session, calling on Marjorie Taylor. And let me also echo Director Olenek's recognition and thanks to Marjorie for her service to Oregon and to PERS.
Vice Chair Fernstall, members of the board, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor from the Director's Office. Thank you very much for that. Yes, this is your 2020 regular session legislative update. It feels like that was so 4 weeks ago, and shazam, the whole world has changed. So during the February session, we were fortunate in that we were able to make our required reports. First of all, to the General Government Subcommittee, we did make our preliminary earnings crediting report, and also the implementation of employer programs is required under Senate Bill 1566 from the 2018 session. So those two, we got to check the box and get them over with. We were also able to make the required report to the Information Management and Technology Committee on the implementation of Senate Bill 1049. A budget note in our PERS budget bill from 2019 actually required us to make the report to IMT and also to Ways and Means. However, due to some scheduling issues and invitations, we were only able to make that presentation to IMT. So we consider that reporting at least for February and the 2020 regular session to be done. However, I would imagine moving forward, there will be plenty of opportunity to speak with the Budget Committee on implementation. Also during February, you'll see in my memo that there were six policy bills that we were following through the process. I'll start on the last two, House Bills 4057 and 4153. Those were related to lottery and the possible opportunity of collegiate betting. Neither of those passed, along with oh so many other bills. However, they could have had an impact on revenue streams into the employer investment fund, incentive fund. So we will keep our eyes on that moving forward. However, not sure if that will come up again in 2020 or 2021, obviously under the current economic circumstances. Four other policy bills that came close but didn't quite make it across the finish line were Senate Bill 1522, which incorporated an amendment, which was actually a redraft of Senate Bill 634 from the 19th session, which would have addressed an issue for OPCERT members who work for online charter schools. It almost made it, but not quite, so I would anticipate sometime either this year during a special session or in the 21 session, you might see provisions of that Senate Bill 634 or 1522 reintroduced for consideration. Also, Senate Bill 1528 is the perennial tax reconnect bill. This is just what we see on an annual basis from the Legislative Revenue Office. We hope that at least sometime this year during a special session that provisions of that measure might be considered again. But if not, I think we'll be okay. All it does is just update the years in our statute. However, we did seek an amendment to that bill that actually updated the required minimum distribution age in our statutes. That was updated in the Federal Secure Act that was approved in December of 19. Senate Bill 1576 was relating to judicial marshals. It would have provided police status to three employees of the judicial branch. This, again, is kind of a perennial bill. It gets better with each time it's introduced. And, again, it almost made it, but not quite. It was originally introduced in the 19th session of Senate Bill 187, but, again, discussed in February as Senate Bill 1576. So, again, I imagine either this year or in 21, the judicial branch will probably reintroduce that piece of legislation. Finally, House Bill 4108 was a redraft of House Bill 2646, which applied to chaplains who work in correctional facilities and how their housing would be applied to their benefits moving forward. The housing allowance would be applied to benefits moving forward. I was assured by the lobbyist advocating for this particular measure that it will be reintroduced at some point moving forward. Two other bills that we had our eyes on, and so many other agencies did too, were House Bills 4163 and House Bill 5204. Those were the end-of-session bills that would have incorporated some program changes and budget reconciliation. Although there's a lot of conversation about a possible special session this week, and frankly, it might be possible because we're already working on fiscal impacts associated with that, I don't anticipate these two bills being on the radar for that immediate special session, but in media reports, we see that other special sessions might occur sometime during the year. So if provisions from 4163 and 5204 aren't accomplished right now, then I would expect they will be addressed at some point during the year and might reflect the current economic conditions the state is in, as opposed to where we were in February. So at this point, I would be happy to answer your questions about the 2020 session, or we could move right on to the possible legislation the agency would like to introduce for 2021.
Any questions from the board on the 2020 session? Hearing none, why don't we move on, Marjorie and Stephanie, to 21.
Great. Stephanie, are you still on the line?
I am.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
So, funny enough, we have been working on agency legislation for the 2021 session since late last fall. As you remember, in our January board presentation, there were a number of possible concepts that we put before the board. However, under further consideration, we've decided to not move forward with the drafting or requesting of drafts for those possible proposals. Those are on pages 3 and 4 of my memo. But we do want to have a brief overview from Stephanie regarding three bills that the agency would like to request for drafting for the 21 session. The first one being technical fixes to Senate Bill 1049. The second would be treatment of common law employees to reflect a legal decision in EWEB. And then finally, the IAP prior year earnings, addressing some issues related to that. So I'll have Stephanie review those three proposals pretty quickly. And then what we anticipate is the agency will submit to DAS tomorrow the request that these bills be drafted for review. And later this fall, the agency will present to the board how these bills have turned out with regard to drafting, and then request that the governor introduce them for the 21 session. So, Stephanie?
Okay, thank you. Again, for the record, this is Stephanie Vaughn with PERS, and I will very quickly try to go through these, and if you have any questions, just let me know as I go through. The first concept are technical fixes to Senate Bill 1049. We've divided those up into three categories or subcategories, the first of which is work after retirement. As we presented in January, the first of those is for early retirees, clarifying that early retirees must have a six-month break in service from all PERS employment in order to be eligible to work unlimited hours. The particular edit will apply also to our existing statute, is not just to the 1049 language. The second is to remove the Social Security provisions of 1049. This is to prevent an altering limitation requirement. Currently, under the language of 1049, if somebody retires, they are not subject to, as I should specify, a normal retiree is able to work unlimited hours until they reach or restart receiving Social Security benefits, and then they are subject to a limit. And then once they reach full Social Security age, they are again unable to work unlimited hours. So we want to remove that Social Security language from the 1049 provisions. The last one is to standardize our provisions between our Tier 1, Tier 2 retirees and our officer retirees that are appointed or elected officials. And currently, the way it is structured, a elected or appointed official that is an officer member is able to work unlimited hours. However, a appointed or elected official under Tier 1, who is a Tier 1 or Tier 2 retiree, is not able to work unlimited hours. So we want to standardize that amongst the plans. For our IAP redirect, we have a terminology, just a technical edit for the IAP on withdrawal. Under the current language, only a vested member terminates their membership on withdrawal. And we want to clarify that anybody who withdraws terminates their membership. The next one is a voluntary or mandatory redeposit after withdrawal. We want to make sure that a Tier 1, Tier 2 member is and officer members are required to redeposit the amount of the employee pension stability account as well as their regular account. And the last one under the IAP redirect is a clarification of accrued after July 1, 2020, basically how we are going to determine that. And we are proposing the language be proportional to the service performed after July 1, 2020. We have a couple of edits to the Employer Incentive Fund and the UAL Resolution Program. These are technical fixes for clarification. The first one is to clarify that for our application windows, we want to clarify that it's the funds available at the time instead of the funds projected to be available, as we have a number of revenue streams that are being projected, but those projections change. So we want to clarify that it's what we have at the time that we open up the window. The second one has to do with the Employer Resolution Program, and we want to remove the language that is specific to the employer's UAL or unfunded liability. Specifically, that's a concern for pooled employers. So we're removing that language. The last one that we have listed in the memo has to do with we'd like to request some clarification on the revenue stream coming from the online sports betting. But this is something that we probably will not introduce as a purse bill, as it doesn't really touch our statutes, but it's something that we probably will request in the 2020 session. And the last one for the Senate Bill 1049 clarifications is the coordination between the new pre-retirement death benefit option for Tier 1, Tier 2 surviving spouses and the Senate Bill 1049. Since they were passed at the same time, that new provision for that new pre-retirement death benefit does not provide any clarification on how it's funded. So we want to clarify that the EPSA will be used to fund that benefit as well. Are there any questions on the technical fixes before I move on? Hearing none, okay. So the next bill is clarification on the treatment of common law employees. And this is in response to the EWEB decision, the Eugene Water and Electric Board decision. And the proposal that we're putting forward basically puts us in the same position that we were in prior to that decision that from the Supreme Court. That decision suggests that the only thing that PERS would need to look at to determine whether a person is eligible for PERS is whether the employee is on the employer's payroll. And even if someone were a common law employee under the IRS standards, they still would not be eligible for PERS. So this is a clarification and request that common law employees would still be eligible for PERS participation, and it puts us back into the same position that we currently are in or were in prior to the decision, where we are making that determination as to whether someone is an independent contractor or whether they actually are an employee of PERS or of the employer subject to PERS.
Stephanie and Martin Buckley, would you expect some pushback from some of the public sector employers concerning this possible legislation?
Board Member Buckley, it's definitely possible. We talked with the employers. We presented this at a meeting with the stakeholders, and we did not receive pushback from, I didn't hear any pushback, and Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, but we didn't hear anything to that effect at that meeting.
Board Member Buckley, this is Marjorie. I would imagine as we see actual language for the piece of legislation we'd like to discuss in the 21 session, and we circulate that more broadly with our employer partners, we might be able to engage in a more robust conversation with them. And then, of course, it will all depend on what happens in 21.
If I understand, this is essentially codifying our current longstanding practice. With the recommendation. This is Lawrence.
Is that Vice Chair?
Yeah.
Yes, that is exactly what we're doing. Our current standard, or our standard prior to the decision, is to use the IRS standard.
Right.
So that is what we would continue to do, yes.
Are there any questions on the proposed legislative concepts for the 2021?
Oh, we've got one more.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Jump
we've
the
got
gun.
One more.
Sorry.
One last. Sorry. The last bill is for charging employers prior year earnings on the IAP contributions. The way the statute is currently structured, it's silent to whether we can charge earnings. We don't have specific statutory authority or direction to charge earnings on prior year earnings. So if an employer corrects reporting or we determine that somebody is eligible for participation that previously was not, so in an eligibility review or something, and an employer is making those contributions into the system, and for all closed years, so all years for which earnings crediting have been credited to the accounts, it's the same way that we handle the Tier 1, Tier 2 accounts, is the employer pays the earnings that would have been earned on those contributions as well as the contributions themselves. So this is a codification of our current practice, our continued practice of charging the employers for those prior year earnings on the IAP contributions as well. And that's the last one. Are there any questions?
Thank you. So sorry for jumping the gun there.
No, that's fine.
Does the board have any questions or comments on these concepts? If not, I would entertain a motion to recommend approval of submitting these requests to DAS for drafting legislative concepts for the 2021 session, which is the beginning of a long process. If I could hear such a motion.
This Board Member Demarest, so moved.
Board Member Jaramillo, second.
Any questions, further comments? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The resolution passes. Thank you very much, Audrey and Stephanie,
thank you.
For that. Now let me turn, we've got two more agenda items, and I'm running a little long here. Let me turn to our Chief Financial Officer and our Budget Officer. We received your memorandum that had all of the detail of the budget development activities. If I could ask you to sort of hit the highlights for us, and then we'll open it up for any board questions. And if I understand it, you'll be back with a revised request in May, and then for final approval by the board in the July meeting.
Sure thing. Vice Chair Frenstahl, members of the board, Richard Horsford, Chief Financial Officer with PERS. I think you hit the summary good that right now the report we presented is giving a high-level summary of what management has put together as our possible budget asks for the 21-23 biennium. This is really our best thinking of trying to address the number of complexities that are occurring within our systems really from end to end. And right today we're not looking for any approval. This is to let the board know where our thinking is and the areas that we've identified that need help. So as you go through the pieces, maybe another thing that's a highlight, we've identified how much each of these cost, but there are a number of areas where we may be able to find some offsetting savings by cutting back on contractors, reallocating resources, and at this point we haven't finalized that exercise. So the goal is really to show for many of these positions the high end of what we could be asking for. As you look at the table on page one, you see that identified potential of about $6.3 million of agency requests. The next line is the state government service charges, which is what our share of state charges that we don't have any control over, so we won't get too deep into that. And the to-be-determined any Senate Bill 1049, it's worth saying that there could be some costs that where we don't finish things from 1049, or there are additional costs that flow into the future based on 1049 activities. So as that comes more into focus, we will come back to the board. With that, I don't think I'm going to try to go through the individual positions, but I'll turn it back over to the board to see if anyone had any thoughts or comments on what we've come up with so far here.
No one has any comments. Thank you, and we look forward to hearing your updated report at the May board meeting.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we can turn to Milliman, our friends Matt and Scott, who have provided an overview of rate tolerating policy, and I think this kind of makes a very good bookend to John Sherman's investment review at the beginning of it. So, gentlemen.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frenstahl. This is Matt Larrabee from Milliman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. This is Scott. Can you hear me as well? Oh, sorry, Scott.
Yes,
sure we can. Okay, great. You can hear Scott except when I'm talking over the top of him. Anyway, we've got just 11 slides today. This is strictly an informational item. There were a couple reasons that we have this on the board agenda for today, talking about rate collaring. One was is that the board is aware the Oregon Secretary of State's office last year conducted a review of PERS, as they termed it, and their recommendations from that was to, with the board and for the board to disseminate to other parties a more robust and detailed lengthier period of time on rate collaring, which is a very important part of rate calculation structure. So we wanted to, as quickly as possible, get in front of the board on that both general issue. But then the Director Olenek and Chief Investment Officer Sherbaum noted, you know, we've had significant turbulence in the markets in the first quarter of this year, and rate collaring is a primary mechanism in the actual calculations and methods to establish contribution rates for employers in a period of significant volatility. So there is very practical interest for this as well. So this is informational in nature, and I would encourage, the board members, we don't have to get a decision on anything today, but the board members and other parties to take the material today under consideration as we move forward for questions about rate setting policy. So turning to slide two, in our material, this very standard slide that most of our presentation, employer contribution rates, as you know, are in effect for a biennium. The current buy-in right now is July 2019 to June 2021. Those rates, based on assets and liabilities for the as of the end 2017, starting in July of next year, July of 2021, will be based on the actuarial valuation that we are conducting this year. And important to note, that will be based on liabilities and assets as the end of 2019. Then the third row shown on slide here is the for July 2023 to June 2025 will be in normal course the first contribution rates that will reflect the effects markets of what has been a very rough first quarter, as we all know. So turning on to slide three material, this slide should look familiar as well as when we put in front of the board quite often. And this is repeat of a slide that we shared with the board in January at its January board meeting once we knew what the preliminary risks were for the systems investments for calendar year 2019. A couple of things to note here. Scott will get into the details on the rate collaring. We in rate collar mechanism, kind of we move top to bottom. We start with an uncollared rate that's shown in the gray, and then we apply collaring if it's applicable, and those are shown by the two rates in blue, the base rate, which is before the effects of site accounts, and the net rate, which is after the effects of site accounts. The materials shown here on slide three were presented also in January, and they reflect our best estimate right now, where at a system level, we believe rates will be for the 2021 to 2023 biennium. A couple of notations here. One is that these are a system average, so you can see our right-hand side here focusing on the collared rate and the collared base rate. Those tend to be right now at the max, the 25 to 26% range. The weighting of tier one or two payroll rates and offset payroll rates at an tier one, tier two rates sit about 3% above rates that are shown on this chart. The offset rates sit about 3% below. Another key listen to the other presenters today is that Chief Investment Officer Sherbum noted that their preliminary estimate for the first quarter right now would be a return for the first quarter of negative 0.8%. Reasonable, important question to ask would be if, for example, we had a negative 7.8% return and we reflected it in the far-hand right of this chart, what would that mean? That would mean that the assets for the systems would be about $1 billion lower than they were excluding site accounts at the end of 2019. And from a contribution rate perspective,
I'm sorry, Matt, you cut off there. How many billions dollars would it be lower approximately?
It would be about $5 billion less in assets, Vice Chair Fernstall, about $5 billion higher in UAL, or unfunded actuarial liability. And from a contribution rate perspective, the contribution rates rather than the ones depicted here, if we were going to set, for example, end of first quarter returns, the rate shown here would be about 3% of payroll higher if the return was negative 7.8%.
Thank you.
So that is maybe a pause there just for a second, see if there are any board questions on introductory material, and then if there aren't, we can turn it over to talk a little bit more about details on the rate collar.
Okay, Scott?
Okay. So starting on slide four, at the highest level, the rate collar is an actuarial method that's used to set the contribution rates for employers in each rate-setting valuation. And it's been used since the 12/31/2005 valuation, which set contribution rates for the 07 to 09 biennium. The kind of the structure of the rate collar was developed during 2005 and 2006 in a series of meetings with the board at the time, and included significant analysis and stochastic analysis to look at how the collar would respond under a wide variety of potential investment returns. So looking at, you know, like we do every year in the financial modeling, looking at 1,000 or multiple thousand scenarios and seeing how things play out under different designs. So the process at that time was trying to balance competing board objectives, and these should all look familiar for the board. These have been in place since right around that same 2004-2005 era. And we'll just note two things here. One is that much of the motivation for the rate caller versus other approaches that Matt will discuss a little bit more on sort of on contribution rates and setting contribution rates is that it's judged to be more transparent than, for example, the common practice of smoothing assets over, you know, multiple years and not reflecting recent investment experience for quite some time. The other thing just to notice is that, as we always discuss with these objectives, they are inherently, there's some tension and a balance needs to be struck between, you know, for example, while the goal is to maintain predictable and stable rates, when there are significant changes in asset levels or assumptions or anything that would affect the rates, there is a balance versus protecting funded status, as the board is well aware. So slide five, oh, I'll pause there. Was there a question?
Scott, this is Steve Buckley. I have two questions.
Yeah.
First, was Milliman the actuary for the plan in the 2005 to 2009 timeframe when the rate collar was discussed and adopted?
Milliman was not. Mercer was the actuary at that time.
And that's what I thought. Second, can you explain why you think that the rate collar is more transparent than the other primary method, asset smoothing for setting employer contribution rates?
Yes. And we'll discuss this a little bit later on, but I would, if we look back at slide three, for example, the fact that...
Get to it, that'd be
the
fine.
Well, I was just, what's worth noting now is I think the fact that Matt was able to walk through and say what the uncollared rate is and what a collared rate was to know what direction that rate would be coming so clearly through each of those biennia, that typically is not something that is calculated and published with that degree of sort of, you know, again, for want of a better word, transparency, in a system that is using, you know, five-year average asset smoothing, for example.
Okay. Thanks.
It's not as clear the directional movement that's going to come at if things continue to assumption. Okay. All right. Slide five. So this, again, this is a graph the board will be familiar with, or a chart that the board will be familiar with, just depicting our usual valuation process. And sort of with the color coding, what information comes into it from PERS, what pieces are adopted by the PERS board, and then what we as the actuary calculate. And just to kind of locate the rate caller in where this sits, it's one of the actuarial methods, sort of in the green box in the middle of the page here. And important to note, it doesn't affect the calculation of the liability or the funded status that we report when every valuation, but it affects how that funded position really translates into the employer contribution rates. So slide six, what the rate caller actually is and what it does. Step one in the process is to calculate the uncollared contribution rate. And so that is a rate that reflects all the assumptions and methods, other methods that have been adopted by the board, and determines a contribution rate that avoids UAL balance worsening in the near term if actual experience meets the assumptions. And furthermore, it's going to systematically return PERS to the 100% funded status target over the time frame if the experience matches assumption. So in calculating that uncollared contribution rate, we are using, as I mentioned, kind of the fair and current market value of assets instead of a multi-year smooth asset measure. And it also uses updated assumed future rate of return based on current capital market outlooks from both kind of our colleagues in the investment space and investment consultants to Treasury as we go through that exercise every 2 years in the experience study process. So all that means is that ideally, the uncollared rate is a contribution level that reflects model practices for assumption and methods for pension plans. By its nature, the uncollared rate on its own weights some of the articulated board objectives more heavily, particularly it weighs protection of funded status more than predictability and stability of rates, because in times of certainly changes in the assets and liabilities, the uncollared rate reflects that pretty straight away, and there is no explicit way to smooth that process through the uncollared rate. So I'll pause there for any questions before we get to step two. Okay, slide seven, step two, moving from the uncollared rate to the collared contribution rate. So if the uncollared rate is above the current rate being charged, then that initial increase and that initial step up to get from where their contribution rate is now to get to the uncollared rate, it can be limited or collared by a formula. And so it means that, you know, one biennium step may be partway there and then get there in the next biennium or potentially later, depending on the size of the ground to be covered. And that results in the collared rate that's actually paid by employers can be temporarily below the uncollared rate as that's systematically spreading large increases across multiple biennia. And also important to note that this isn't a static thing, so that additional market data, asset experience, changes in assumptions are reflected and will adjust the size of the step needed. So if assets underperform, then each subsequent step will reflect that and will be larger than it otherwise would have been. On the flip side of that, if assets recover after a downturn, for example, then what was scheduled as a given size step may be smaller at the next biennium. And so we've seen that certainly over the last decade of plus of experience with the rate collar kind of work both ways. The width of the collar is an important aspect of how this is kind of structured. And the intent would be to calibrate it to balance the competing objectives. If it's too wide, it's really just the same as having no collar and won't make for any stability or predictability in the rates. And if it's too narrow, you could end up in a situation wherein, you know, prolonged downturns or bad scenarios, the funded status is not it's not sufficiently responsive to restore the funded status as desired. Moving on to slide eight. So this picture again will look somewhat familiar to the board from a few prior presentations, but this walks through some of the mechanics of the rate collar itself, that the width of the collar, the maximum rate change permitted by the collar, is 20% of the rate currently in effect, but no less than 3% of payroll. And then if the funded status of the rate pool or the employer for which the rate collar is getting calculated is 60% or lower, then that width of the collar is doubled, so to be 40% of the rate currently in effect or 6% of pay. And that kind of is a sliding scale of funded status is between 60 and 70%. It's prorated between the single and double collar. So the picture here, the green is depicting around assuming that the prior rate was 20% of payroll. The green is sort of the single collar range of how much you can move up or down. And the blue up to 28% or down to 12 in this case is the double collar range. I mentioned, but it's important to note that collars are calculated at a rate pool level, and so it's not the same for every employer in the system, even though we kind of depict it that way for board material sometimes for clarity. Any questions on there, or I'll move on to slide nine. Okay. Slide nine, last couple points to make before letting Matt wrap up here. What's changed since the original design of the rate collar? So as I mentioned, the width is determined by 20% of the rate currently in effect or 3% of payroll. At the time that the rate collar was being designed, the rate currently in effect for most employers was below 15% of payroll. So that kind of 3% of payroll minimum width was what governed for most. The single collar's width was 3% of pay and the double collar was 6% of pay. Now, as you know, shown on slide three and Matt's comments with that, the tier one, tier two rate, if we're talking about the rate set for that, rate pools tied into tier one, tier two, is closer to 30% of payroll. So now the single collar width is about 6% of payroll, and the width of the double collar is about 12% of payroll. So even with the same mechanism, it is more responsive, allows bigger changes in rates, given the baseline starting point of where the contributions are at the moment. And last kind of full bullet on this slide, also important to notice that one thing that has changed since the design of this was the reamortization of Tier 1, Tier 2 UAL over 22 years under Senate Bill 1049. So what that does affect the uncollared rate, and it lowers it, delays the time at which the plan is expected to get out to 100% funded in the future. And because it lowers the uncollared rate, it does actually make it less likely that the collar restricts and limits the rate, given that that rate has kind of been flattened out and extended over the through the reamortization period. Okay. And Mac will jump in with slide 10 if there's not any questions there.
Okay. So turn to slide 10 of the presentation to try to help answer the question that Board Member Buckley, you posed. So we use a rate collar methodology in Oregon. This has been the case for more than a decade now, but it is not the methodology that is used by most system peers around the country. So what we do, the way I would characterize the key thing is calculation of the uncollared rate. It reflects prudent assumptions. Reflects best practices for things like amortization period, and it reflects all market investment knowledge, that uncollared rate. And then really there is a management or smoothing actually paid through the marine calculation. So the uncollared rate, I kind of view it using this graphic here on slide 10 as output. The uncollared rate is an output based on best practices, prudent assumptions, and market assets, and then the collar itself put to the collar base and net rates. But given that most systems do not use a rate collaring methodology, what is the alternative that they typically do, whether it's a board or a legislature? And the answer to that is that systems smooth their inputs, the calculation, rather than smoothing the output. As you noted, Board Member, a typical smooth puts would say we have a bad investment, or like books will be in the cards here for 2008. We could use a smooth market value, a smooth asset measure to calculate the rates rather than market measure. So 2020 was bad, but we'll only reflect one-fifth of the investment loss in the 2020 calculations, and then we'll systematically to that 2020 loss each and every year for the next 5 years in the rate calculations. The other areas where you'll see other systems, if they feel like they need to manage rates in terms of smoothing input, is the investment return assumption. The PERS board, I'm very pleased to say, has done an excellent job, and we've got this well documented in the public record of listening to the advice from the investment consultant, from Oregon Investment Council, and selecting a return assumption that is prudent and matched up with the outside consultant's recommendations. It is not unusual in other systems around the country, if they want to manage the contribution rates, that they will perhaps listen to the consultant and then come to a different and more optimistic decision with, to a great extent, right, and force for that optimism being to manage the contribution rate rather than leaving that as a prudent estimate outlook for future experience. The other area you'll see kind of a variance from best practices with other peer systems in terms of smoothing inputs is on the amortization period. The amortization period that is for PERS, except for the 1049 legislation, is amortization periods of 20 years or less. It's 20 years for Tier 1, Tier 2, and 16 years for OPSERP. Those are considered best practices amortization period lengths because you're not really having significant material net negative amortization. A lot of other systems will have a 30-year amortization, which does create, as we've shown to the board in times past, an extended period of net negative amortization. And so using 2020 as an example, seeing this in 2008,
When 2008 occurred, some systems that were using five-year asset smoothing and input, they'll, you know, well, let's smooth assets over 15 years rather than, or if they were using year amortization already and 2008's a bad, let's extend that amortization out to period out to 35 or 40 years. So why, in our opinion, do we think that the rate collaring is more transparent? When you do those smoothing of inputs, you lose that kind of signal, which is the uncollared rate. There's nothing really track consistent manner that follows best practices and prudent assumptions for what would the contribution rate be if we could move to something that a prudent investment return assumption, a distance amortization method, and all of our market asset knowledge. If you don't have that signal, I think that makes things much more for interested parties, governance boards, legislatures, and things like that. Turning on to the last slide of the presentation, which is slide 11, so this is our wrap-up slide. The rates, as we discussed earlier, the rates that will go into effect this July will be will be based on assets and liability levels as of the end of last year. We've already estimated those rates both in the January meeting and repeated those three today. The employer rates proposed for will be presented at our October 2nd PERS board meeting. Under our standard rate setting calendar, the effects of the current downturn would first be reflected in the 23-25 by rates. And then kind of a point of the meeting here and this material was that we would be happy, we want to get the board continue to inform you and other interested parties on the rate collaring methodology, and we provide analysis of any alternatives or changes to the rate in subsequent meeting if the board members or other interested parties through communication with the board or the agency identify alternatives for consideration. This would, in normal course, inform the board's next review of methods and assumptions in 2021. And in terms of timing, our financial side, which under the director's calendar is currently slated for the December meeting, that would be a natural time to analyze these alternatives using our variable return model. And that's really to analyze, you know, trade-off and kind of balance competing board objectives and what is always going to be an uncertain and volatile future for investment returns for the system. So that can kind of concludes our written remarks. Scott and I'd be happy, appreciate the patience and the time on this, and would be happy to field any additional questions that the board may have.
This is Lawrence Fernstall. Thanks, Matt and Scott, for that excellent presentation. Personally, I think you make a compelling case for the benefits of the rate collar. And I think the thing I would like to see is, and December meeting sounds like a good time to do that kind of stochastic modeling, is if we reviewed either of the assumptions, if we change them up or down by some plausible amount, meaning the percentage width of the collars or the minimum width of the collars, how does that affect sort of the results? In other words, can we, are we, does the modeling suggest that where we are now is a good and stable place in terms of the width of the collars? Or should we think about the possible impact of changing them either one way or the other?
I think that is a appreciate the feedback on that, Vice Chair Fernstall. Yeah, going to slide 9 in presentation materials. I think that is a key point is both looking at the, potentially the sensitivity to the investment assumptions that's used, but also cognizant of the fact that when the board very proactively put this into place 15 years ago, that the board, that the effectively a single collar could be summarized as 3% of payroll, and a double collar could be summarized as 6% of payroll. And now that paradigm has shifted, now really single and double are 6 and 12.
Right.
Obviously, you know, we could for this, and there would be a trade-off there, and I think that would be a couple of policy alternatives, and we'd be very pleased to that for the board.
That'd be great. Other questions or comments from the board?
Steve Buckley, I'll provide my comments. And I think the first thing is that this review of the rate collaring isn't a knee-jerk reaction by the board to the investment environment of the first quarter of this year. It's really the result of the GRS Retirement Consulting Report, which reviewed the methods, assumptions, and data used in the December 31, 2017 valuation, and GRS's recommendation that the current rate collaring formula is contributing to the fund's unfunded actuarial liability. You know, in 2005 through 2007, when the board adopted the rate collaring, we were in a very different environment. The plan was more than 100% funded. And I don't think that the board's really taken a comprehensive study or review of the decisions made by the board in 2007 up through the present. So my thinking would be perhaps a little bit more of a thorough review than Mr. Fernstahl suggested, that we ask Milliman in the next several meetings leading up to the December meeting to help the board reevaluate whether the current rate collaring policy is the right policy to address the funding challenges that PERS is currently facing. And the review could possibly focus on the pros and cons of an asset smoothing method versus the rate collaring method. And if the rate collaring method is the preferred method, are the current parameters, as Lawrence has suggested, the width of the collar with the maximum employer contribution rate increase at 20% in a single collar, 40% in a double collar, still correct? Maybe the analysis should include whether there would be a third collar with even a you know, more significant rate increase based on a particular a funded status. So I think it's been 15 years since this has been looked at thoroughly. We're in a different environment than we were in 2007, and it'd be a good time to undertake a you know, comprehensive review of how employer contribution rates are set.
If I could just add to Board Member Buckley's comments, while I understand the criticisms that Milliman has put out of the asset smoothing approach, particularly with plans that might be less disciplined, it seems to me that it's also possible to have a disciplined asset smoothing approach where one uses reports on both smoothed and unsmoothed assets, just like one reports, the PERS reports on both the collared and uncollared rates. So just to build on to that, I would like to see in the modeling, I'm a sort of numbers guy, you know, if there was a good smoothing, whether that's a 3-year or a 5-year, whatever the best practice is, how would that look different from what we are doing in terms of the outcome of the rates that would result from that process?
Thank you, Board Member Buckley and Vice Chair Fernstahl. I think these are excellent comments and feedback for us to take into consideration for presentations in the upcoming year. And I will note that when the original collar was put back in 2005, which is, Board Member Buckley noted, was a very different situation in a lot of ways, that, you know, the implementation and study that was really placing 5-year asset smoothing approach, which had been used by PERS previously, and I think a 5-year asset smoothing, if you're going to smooth the assets as an input, would be a best practice. It really put that side by side with the collar. Mm-hmm. The collar it was developed, and it was really different ways to kind of get to the same result, if you will. I think that a comment you made is important here on this as well, Vice, which is that asset smoothing deals with one particular input, which is the assets.
Right.
If one was going to, and I think the GRS study tried to accomplish this, was going to try to do a little bit of a kind of rear view mirror analysis of changes in the UAL in the system over the past 10 years or so, you know, a major source of the change, not just in the investment returns, it's been the change to the an assumption, which lowered
right.
the discount rate, increased our calculated liabilities, increased the UAL, which is why I think that assessment of the sensitivity of the calculations and the methodology that's used, if you change the investment return assumption based on the investment consultants and treasury's advice, is important as well. And it is an issue that systems that don't use a rate collar but use the more traditional just asset smoothing approach have struggled with dealing with the investment consultants' advice, because they don't have a mechanism to smooth the rate output if their investment consultant says you really need to lower your return. The policy response has been to maybe not lower the assumption as much as would be prudent, and or increase that amortization period to a length for that change where you are getting a more substantive material period of net negative amortization. But these are all things that we can kind of really quantify for the board to take a deep dive on it, if you will.
That sounds great. Any other comments or questions from the board? All right. I just have one more thing to note for the record. I'd like to acknowledge and thank two members of the public, Eric Fruits and Douglas Berg. They submitted to, individually public testimony in writing, and that was shared with the board. I ask that their public testimony be included in the minutes of this meeting, and I'd like to just note that we are grateful for all public comments received. With that, unless there are any more business to come before the board, I'd like to thank the public who is listening and all my fellow board members for their attention and patience today, and I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you.